Slipping two paper clips off the documents, he went to the locker and, with a movement that was almost automatic, unbent both clips, inserted first one and then the other into the padlock, and with a single deft movement, sprung it open. He paused. How did he know how to do that? From his special forces days? His memory of that time was still so damnably miasmic. He peered into the cabinet. It held a black suit, a white shirt, a tie, shoes, and socks. He touched the material of the suit, soft and elegant, as familiar as his own skin. He felt a prickling sensation at the base of his neck. He searched the suit and pants, going first to the pocket that he supposedly remembered held his FBI wallet. Nothing. The other pockets, all the little custom-made slots and pouches, were there, and all were empty. No ID. Nothing. He slipped off his hospital gown and put on the shirt, stroking the fine pinpoint cotton. Then came the pants, the Xenia tie, the jacket, the socks. As he picked up the John Lobb shoes, he thought of something, flipped over the left shoe, and detached the heel. There, nestled in a carved hollow, was a razor blade, a set of lock picks, two sealed ampules of chemicals, and a tightly folded $100 bill. He stared. Could this, too, be a product of his delusional FBI period? Refastening the heel, he put on the shoes. He walked to the window, unlatched it, and swung it open. A breeze scented with hemlocks flowed through the vertical iron bars. He tried again to summon his last memory. They said he had been in there 6 months. Had it been winter then? He tried desperately to remember, to see the landscape in front of him covered with snow, but could not. Flexing his arms, he reached out and grasped two adjoining metal bars. They were wrought iron, of poor quality, and corroded. With all his force, he pushed outward with each hand. Slowly but surely, the wrought iron deformed under his immense strength, until an opening large enough for him to slip through had been made. He let go, breathing hard. But now was not the time to leave. No, he needed answers first. He fastened the window shut and drew the curtains. Moving cautiously, he went to the door of his room, tested the knob. Locked, of course. In 10 seconds he had picked it with the aid of the paper clips, again marveling at his instinctual skill. He cracked the door and peered out. The lights were on in the hall, and at the far end he could see a nurse's station attended by a nurse and two orderlies. All were alert and busy. He waited, timing his exit until their attention was elsewhere, then ducked out of the door and pressed himself into the darkness of the next doorway. Another patient? With a deft twist of the paper clips, the lock opened, and he found himself in a room like his own, only much smaller. A man lay in the single bed. He too had a shaved head, but he looked thin and wasted, and his bare arm sported the old tracks of a heroin addict. His bed had been outfitted with the same medical device Pendergast had noticed in his own room. With extreme caution, Pendergast exited the dark space and moved down the long hall. Each room he peered into was similar, a sleeping patient with a shaved head, frequently gaunt and wasted-looking. This was getting him nowhere. He paused to consider the possibilities. Either his version of reality was correct, or theirs was correct. Either way, unfortunately, seemed to indicate that he was crazy. He needed more information to choose which of the two insanities was real. Stepping out of the last patient's room, he stuck his hands in his pockets and, not sure exactly what he was doing, and yet strangely certain of his actions, strolled back down the hall toward the nurse's station. The two orderlies, big, strapping, blonde men, 6 feet 4 inches, a matched set, watched him approach, first with incomprehension on their faces, and then with alarm. He saw that both men were armed. "Hey! Hey!" one of them cried, flummoxed at his appearance. "Who the hell are you?" He strolled up to them. "Pendergast at your service. The patient from room 113? In a practiced move, they parted and took up positions on either side of him. "Okay," the first said, speaking calmly. "We're going to take you back to your room, nice and easy, understood?" Pendergast did not move. "I'm afraid that's not acceptable." They both moved a little closer. "Nobody wants any trouble." "Incorrect. I do want trouble. In fact, I positively welcome it." The first orderly reached out and gently grasped his arm. "Enough with the tough talk, friend. Let's go back to bed." "I do hate being touched." The second orderly now moved in, crowding him. The orderly's grip tightened. "Let's go, Mr. Pendergast." There was a flicker of movement, the sound of a fist hitting a gut, the sudden wheeze of expelled air, and then the orderly buckled over and collapsed to the floor, grasping his diaphragm. The second orderly swung to grab Pendergast, and a moment later was doubled up on the floor as well. The nurse at the station turned toward an alarm, pulled it, and a siren began to wail. Red lights went on, and Pendergast could hear automatic bolts shooting in various door locks. Almost instantly, half a dozen monster orderlies appeared out of nowhere and converged on the nurse's station, where Pendergast stood calmly with crossed arms. They surrounded him, weapons drawn. The two orderlies on the floor continued to lie in a fetal position, gasping and sucking in air, unable to speak.
"Gentlemen, I'm ready to go back to my room," said Pendergast, "but please, don't touch me. I have a thing about it, you might say."
"Just get the hell going,"
said one of the orderlies, apparently the leader.
"Move!"
Pendergast strolled down the hallway, orderlies before and after. They entered the room, and one turned on the light, the last one shutting and locking the door. The lead orderly gestured toward the open metal cabinet, at the foot of which lay Pendergast's hospital gown.
"Strip off your clothes and get back in your gown," he said.
Meanwhile, another orderly was speaking on a walkie-talkie, and Pendergast could hear him assuring someone that all was under control. The sirens stopped and silence descended once again.
"I said strip."
Pendergast turned his back on the orderly, facing the locker, but made no move to take off his clothes. A moment passed, and then the lead orderly stepped forward and grabbed him by the shoulder, pulling him around.
"I said—"
He fell silent as the barrel of a Smith & Wesson 38, removed from one of the disabled orderlies, was pressed against his head. "All the radios on the floor," Pendergast said in a calm, firm voice. "Then the weapons, and all your keys." Unnerved at the sight of a gun in a patient's hand, the orderlies quickly complied, the radios and pistols piling up on the Persian carpet. Pendergast, still covering the head orderly, sorted through the pile, pulling out one of the radios. He removed the batteries from the others and ejected the rounds from the revolvers, stuffing batteries and bullets into the pocket of his jacket. Sorting through the keys, he found a master, stuck it into the keyhole of his room door, and snapped it off. He turned the working radio over in his hands, found the panic button, and pressed it. The alarm shrieked back to life.
"Elopement," he cried into the radio. "Room 113. He's got a gun. He went out the window. He's running towards the woods."
Then he turned off the radio, plucked out its batteries in turn, and tossed it on the floor. "Good evening, gentlemen." He nodded at them gravely, then unlatched the window again and leaped out into the night. As he pressed himself against the dark side of the mansion, the lawn and grounds suddenly blazed with floodlights. He could hear shouts over the sound of the alarms. Moving alongside the edge of the building, keeping behind the shrubbery, he worked his way along the bulk of the great mansion turned insane asylum. As he had hoped, security officers and orderlies were running across the lawn, flashlight beams dancing about, all operating on the assumption he had fled into the woods. Instead, Pendergast remained against the building, an almost invisible shadow moving slowly and carefully. In a few minutes, he had worked his way around to the front. Here he stopped to reconnoiter. A sweeping driveway curved through a vast lawn to a porte cochere at the building's entrance, tastefully planted with arbor vitae. Flitting across the gravel drive, Pendergast secreted himself in the dense shrubbery beside the porte cochere. It took just under 5 minutes for a late model Lexus to come tearing down the driveway, scattering gravel, and slow to a stop under the porte cochere. Excellent. Most excellent. As the door was flung open, Pendergast dashed forward and rammed the driver. It was, as he'd expected, Dr. Augustine, back into the automobile, forcing him into his seat. Keeping the doctor covered with the gun, he quickly slipped into the passenger's seat.
"Do keep driving," he said as he closed the door.
The car continued down the driveway and back out toward what was evidently a manned guardhouse and gate. Pendergast slid off the seat and crouched under the dashboard.
"Tell them you forgot something and we'll be right back. Deviate from the script and you will be shot."
The doctor complied. The gate opened. Pendergast rose back onto the seat as the vehicle accelerated.
"Turn right."
The car turned right onto a lonely country road. Pendergast turned on the vehicle's GPS and studied it briefly.
"Ah, I see we're nowhere near Saranac Lake, but quite a lot closer to the Canadian border."
He looked over at Dr. Augustine and removed the cell phone from his coat pocket. Keeping his eye on the GPS, he gave the doctor a series of directions. Half an hour later, the car was proceeding down a dirt track which dead-ended at a lonely pond.
"Stop here."
The doctor stopped. His lips were set in a thin line, and he was white-faced.
"Dr. Augustine, do you realize the consequences of kidnapping a federal agent? I could kill you right now and get a medal for it. Unless, of course, I'm as crazy as you claim, in which case I'll be locked up. But either way, my dear doctor, you will be dead."
No answer.
"And I will kill you. I want to kill you.
The only thing that will stop me is a full, immediate, and complete explanation of this setup."
"What makes you think this is a setup?" came the doctor's quavering voice. "That's your delusion talking."
"Because I knew how to pick a lock. I took this revolver away from an orderly as easy as taking candy from a baby."
"Of course you did. That's your standard special forces training."
"I'm too strong to have been locked in a mental hospital for 6 months. I bent the bars in my window.
For God's sake, you spent half your time working out in our gym. Don't you remember?
A silence. Then Pendergast said, It was a masterful job. You almost had me believing you. But I grew suspicious again when Helen did not rise to my comment about the moon. Sharing the full moonrise was always our private signal. That put me on my guard. And then I knew for certain it was a setup when Helen took my hands in hers.
And how in God's name did you know that?
Because she still had her left hand. There's one memory in my life that's so powerful that I know it can't be a delusion. It occurred during the African hunting expedition in which Helen was attacked by a lion. My memory of the moment when I found her severed hand, still bearing its wedding ring, is seared too deep in my memory to be anything but real. The doctor was silent. The moon shone off the small lake. A loon called from some distant shore. Pendergast cocked the Smith & Wesson. I've endured enough prevarication. Tell me the truth. One more lie, and you're dead.
How will you know it's a lie? Asked the doctor quietly.
It becomes a lie when I don't believe it.
I see. And what's in it for me if I cooperate?
You'll be permitted to live. The doctor took a deep, shuddering breath.
Let's start with my name. It's not Augustine. It's Grundman. Dr. William Grundman.
Keep going.
For the past decade, I've been experimenting with memory neurons. I discovered a gene known as NPAS4.
Which is?
It controls the neurons of your memory. Memory, you see, is physical. It's stored through a combination of neurochemicals and trapped electrical potentials. By controlling NPAS4, I learned how to locate the neural networks that store specific memories. I learned how to manipulate those neurons. I learned how to erase them. Not delete, that would cause brain damage, but erase, a far more delicate operation.
He paused.
Do you believe me so far?
You're still alive, aren't you?
I discovered that this technique could be very lucrative. I started a clinic under the cover of the Stony Mountain Sanatorium. While the sanatorium is visible, naturally, what goes on there is quite underground.
Continue.
People come to my underground clinic to be rid of memories they no longer want. I'm sure you can imagine all sorts of situations in which that would be desirable. I make those memories go away for a price. And for a time, that was satisfactory. But then my research led me to a discovery that was even more extraordinary. I theorized that I could do more than erase memories. I could also create them. I could program new memories. Imagine the potential market for that. For the right price, you could be given the memory of having spent a weekend at Cap d'Antibes with the Hollywood starlet of your choice, or of scaling Everest with Mallory, or of conducting the New York Philharmonic in Mahler's Ninth.
As he spoke, the doctor's eyes shone with a kind of inner light. But then the eyes glanced at the gun again, and they became veiled and anxious once more.
Can't you lower that gun?
Pendergast shook his head. Just keep talking.
Okay. Okay. I needed guinea pigs in order to perfect the memory insertion procedure. You can imagine the results of programming the wrong memories. So I arranged to have indigent people, drug addicts, the homeless, secretly transferred up to my clinic from New York City hospitals.
Those are the gaunt patients I saw around me.
Yes.
People nobody would miss.
That is correct.
And how did I get there?
Ah,
what a lot of trouble you were.
It seems that, as part of some case you were working on, you became suspicious of Stony Mountain. You managed to check yourself into Bellevue, posing as a homeless tubercular, and you were duly transferred up here. But there was an accident, a miscommunication, and your clothes ended up being transferred with you. Those were not the clothes of a homeless drifter. I became suspicious, made inquiries, and ultimately learned who you really were. I couldn't just kill you. As you pointed out, killing a federal agent is never the best solution. Much better would be to reprogram you with new memories, to gaslight you, as it were, erase from your memory the real reasons for your coming here, and to add new memories that would, in the end, convince your superiors and loved ones that you had become mentally ill. After that, no one listens to a crazy person. No matter what you said, it would be chalked up to your illness.
Diogenes and Helen were not real.
No, they were phantoms reconstructed out of your memory by manipulating NPAS-4.
Grundman paused.
It appears my research into Helen could have been a little more thorough.
And the dummy? Pendergast asked.
Ah, the dummy. I call him Dr. Augustine. He's a crucial part of the treatment. He doesn't exist either.
The dummy isn't real.
He's the conduit, the vehicle, the Trojan horse, as it were, which I first insinuate into the patient's mind. If I can plant Dr. Augustine in your mind, I can use him to leverage any other memory I wish to insert.
There was a long silence, interrupted by the calling of the loons. The full moon cast a buttery light over the water. Pendergast said nothing. The doctor stirred nervously in his seat.
I assume that since you haven't killed me, you accept my story?
Pendergast did not answer directly. Instead, he said, "Step out of the car."
"You're going to leave me here?"
"It's a lovely summer evening for a walk. The main road is about 10 miles back. The local police will probably pick you up before you have to trek the whole distance." He waved the doctor's cell phone meaningfully. "You'll miss a SWAT team raid on your clinic, of course. Lucky you." Grundman opened the door and stepped out into the night. Pendergast slid over to the driver's seat, turned the car around, and headed slowly back down the dirt road. Behind him, he could see Grundman standing at the verge of the lake, silhouetted in the moonlit water. With Grundman's phone in his hand, he began to dial the number of the New York field office of the FBI. The first step toward raiding and shutting down Stony Mountain. But he didn't complete the call. Slowly, he let the phone drop into his lap. He knew who he was. Knew without a shred of doubt. He was Special Agent Aloysius Pendergast of the FBI. This episode at Stony Mountain had been a nightmare. A waking delusion. But now, it was over. Dr. Grundman's treatment had been fiendishly effective, but it had failed in the end, as it must. His mind, his memories were simply too strong to erase or manipulate for long. Now he knew, with utter conviction, who he really was. He knew his true history. It was coming back to him at last. He could put all this behind him, get on with his life, his real life. And yet...
He looked down at the phone in his lap. As he did so, he glimpsed something in the rearview mirror, something he unaccountably had not noticed before. There, sitting in the back seat of the car, staring back at him with blue, unblinking eyes, painted red lips, and dressed in a white lab coat with the polished brown shoes, was Dr. Augustine.
MJ Rose versus Lisa Gardner. Old World versus Young Gun. Pragmatic versus the occult. Actual versus the surely impossible. That's the premise MJ Rose and Lisa Gardner started with. The end result? A cunningly clever tale. MJ Rose doesn't believe she invented Malachi Samuels any more than he may have invented her, but certainly Samuels changed her writing career when he first showed up in The Reincarnationist, 2007. Samuels became the impetus for MJ to take her first foray into metaphysical and historical fiction, and she hasn't turned back from that course since. Samuels is, without question, unique. He's an enigmatic Jungian therapist, entrenched in research into past life regressions, a journey he's never actually been able to take himself, which is partly why that's become his obsession. The other reason is that, like MJ, his ancestors, going back to the 19th century, have been invested in questioning the mystical lines between past and present. Bringing law enforcement face to face with Malachi Samuels, a man who's managed to evade them at every turn for years, intrigued MJ, especially when the cop in question would be one of her favorites, Detective D.D. Warren. Here's an interesting fact. Lisa Gardner's D.D. Warren actually exists in real life. Gardner named her hardened Boston detective after her neighbor, a beautiful blonde best known for her baking and gardening skills. In the beginning, Lisa intended for D.D. to only appear in one chapter of Gardner's sniper novel, Alone. But D.D.'s brash Boston attitude and relentless determination quickly captured readers' imaginations. Before she knew it, Lisa ended up writing half a dozen novels featuring her neighbor's namesake. The decision to use D.D. for this story was an easy one. Who better to take on the charming, enigmatic Dr. Malachi Samuels, a man suspected of multiple murders but proved guilty of none, than a young, street-smart homicide cop? Add in the spice of Boston's Chinatown and the legend of a rare artifact, and you have the perfect recipe for a thriller. Or maybe something else entirely. Something unexpected.
The Laughing Buddha. New York City, 1884. Twilight settled over the city, shrouding it in a grayish haze. He hated this time of day, the hour lost between darkness and light, when everything became indistinct. Standing in the shadows, he watched the mansion from across the street. Linden trees partially hid the Queen Anne-style villa, but he could see light glowing through the glass sunburst below the curved top window. The lugubrious strains of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata wafted from the open balcony door, appropriate accompaniment to the gloomy dusk. Even in this murkiness, the elaborate building with its gables, scrolled wrought iron railing, and dozens of gargoyles tucked under the eaves was an impressive sight, a symbol of wealth. But not his wealth. Unconsciously, he clenched his jaw, felt the tightness, then forced those muscles to relax. The front door, with its bas-relief coat of arms of a giant bird rising from a pyre, opened, and a finely dressed woman stepped out. She didn't have any idea what she might be coming home to later that evening, but he did, and thought about how, if the worst happened, she'd accept his sympathy, come to rely on it, and never guess he'd been the one to orchestrate her grief.
Percy? Esme? Hurry now, we can't be late for your cousin's birthday party, she called.
The children ran past her. the 10-year-old boy and his 8-year-old sister scampering down the steps and preceding their mother into the waiting carriage. Once the sound of the children's laughter and the hoofs clomping on cobblestones was far in the distance, the man crept across the street and silently let himself into the house. Quietly as he could, he traversed the black and white marble squares in the imposing foyer and walked down a hallway to the library's open doorway, where Trevor Talmadge worked at his desk, bent over his papers, reading and making notes, oblivious to the intruder.
"Well, aren't you the busy boy?"
Momentarily startled, Trevor looked up, then smiled indulgently.
"When did you get here? Why didn't Peter announce you?" "I let myself in."
"I didn't know you still had a key," he said, sounding more tired than surprised at the news.
"Would you like it back?"
A moment's hesitation. Trevor was considering it, but would the bastard have the nerve to say yes?
"No, of course not. Would you like a glass of port? I just got a new shipment from Madeira."
Trevor motioned toward the crystal decanters and glasses on the sideboard.
"That's sweet stuff. I'll take a brandy."
Trevor rose to get him the libation and refill his own glass at the same time, and Davenport eyed the papers overflowing the desk.
"So at last I see the famed text. Out of the vault for an evening. How are the translations going?"
"Amazingly well."
Now there was palpable excitement in Trevor's voice.
"According to the scribe who wrote this, the lost memory tools were absolutely not a legend. They existed. He saw them and gives a full description of each of the amulets, ornaments, and stones. He writes that they were all smuggled out of India and brought into Egypt well before 1500 BC, which, you realize, suggests present-day historians are incorrect about when the trade routes opened. This is going to create a lot of controversy when I publish."
"You're still planning on publishing?"
Trevor handed his brother a glass filled with amber that shimmered like gold in the lamplight.
"Of course, and please don't try to argue me out of it again. Our father created the Talmadge Trust because he believed history was important. He who controls the past controls the future. I firmly agree, and..."
"Control is exactly why you can't publish. Don't you understand just how much control you'd be giving up?"
Davenport interrupted, pleading, really hoping, now that he was there, that Trevor would not force his hand.
"If these tools exist, and if they can aid people in rediscovering their past lives, we, you, me, and every member of the Phoenix Club, need to ensure this power is used for the good of all men, not selfishly exploited,"
Trevor argued.
"That document was found at an excavation by a man who was paid with our father's money. I won't let you do this."
"You won't let me do this? You can't stop me!"
Trevor laughed derisively.
"Don't you understand how meaningful this is? How spiritually significant? It's not a cache of gold and silver coins we're arguing over. This could be the key to finding proof that we return in new incarnations. We can't own information like this. It has to be available to everyone. How else will the actual memory tools be found? This discussion is closed."
"The decision to publish is not yours alone,"
Davenport said.
"I can say that same sentence back to you," Trevor retorted.
"Damn you!"
Davenport slammed down his glass of brandy so hard that it shattered, spilled liquor quickly threatening to ruin the papers. Annoyed with his brother, no, with himself, for letting Davenport get to him, Trevor cursed as he scooped up the ancient text and placed it out of harm's way on top of the books on a shelf behind him. But there were still his notes to salvage. As fast as he could, he grabbed pile after pile of his papers and put them on top of other books on other shelves. He was turned away from his brother, so he didn't see him draw the small silver revolver from his jacket pocket, or see the competitive grimace on his brother's face, as if they were children playing a game that Davenport was determined to win. The force of the bullet slammed Trevor forward into the shelves, the impact of his body pushing one pile of his notes behind a row of books. He reached out to steady himself, grabbed hold of a leather volume that ironically turned out to be the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It fell with him onto the floor. Blood spilling out of him as quickly as the brandy spilled out of the broken glass, Trevor lay dying, watching his brother steal out of the library, pistol back in his pocket, spoils under his arm, fearing, until he stopped thinking completely, what would become of the precious knowledge he tried but failed so miserably to protect. Chinatown, Boston. Present day. The book didn't save him in the end. The old volume, leather-bound with fading gold embossing and frayed edges, remained partially grasped in the dead man's right hand, where he'd collapsed onto the floor behind his massive desk, felled by a gunshot wound to the chest. Now, Boston Sergeant Detective D.D. Warren stood within an inch of the victim's well-dressed body, one of the only spaces available in the cluttered office, and did her best to interpret the scene. "He held it up," she mused out loud to her partners, Neil and Phil. She gestured to the fallen tome. "Saw the gun, responded instinctively to block the shot." Neil, the youngest member of their squad and a former EMT, immediately shook his head.
"Nah, no sign of gunpowder, no damage from a slug. Victim grabbed the book on the way down."
Neil pointed to a fanned-out pile of papers that teetered dangerously close to the edge of the marble-topped desk.
"Bet the book was on top. Impact of the bullet spun the victim to his left. He reached for the desk but caught the book instead. Took it with him to the floor."
"Book would have been knocked to the side," Dee Dee countered.
This kind of crime scene back and forth was one of her favorite games. As far as she was concerned, dead men did tell tales.
"Collateral damage, whereas our guy has the novel halfway in his hand."
"You want to know how many miscellaneous objects I've had to pry from dead men's hands?"
Neil shrugged.
"People see the end coming and reflexively hold tight. I don't know. Maybe they think if they cling hard enough to this world, they won't have to pass to the next."
"No way to prove it," Phil muttered from the doorway.
The senior member of their squad, he was mid-50s with a devoted wife, four kids, and rapidly thinning hair. Being a family man didn't mean he was too squeamish to view the victim up close and personal. Two hulking Fu lions, however, carved from solid stone and standing 5 feet high, currently kept him in place. Or maybe it was the brightly painted ceramic dragon that roared across the front edge of the marble desk. Or the plethora of jade statuary that sprouted like oversized leaves from cluttered rows of shelves, crammed with more leather-bound novels. Phil held a mask up to his mouth, not for the smell, but because sneezing would absolutely, positively ruin their crime scene, and in a space this cramped and dusty, it was almost impossible not to. Dee Dee straightened, pinching the bridge of her nose as she worked to avert her own reaction to the musty air.
"All right, let's start with victimology. What do we got?"
Phil did the honors.
"Victim is Mr. John Wen. 58, widowed, no record, no outstanding warrants. According to his shop clerk, Judy Chan, who found the body first thing this morning, Mr. Wen was a quiet soul, devoted to his work, which, as you can probably guess by looking around, involved importing ancient Chinese artifacts. And not the cheap kind. He was the real deal. Background in antiquities, elite roster of clients, handled custom orders, that kind of thing. He liked the hunt and authenticating the pieces. Her job was to deal with the public."
Dee Dee nodded. It would explain the location of Wen's shop, tucked away from the hustle and bustle of Beach Street, which formed the brightly decorated main artery running through the heart of Chinatown. Also, in contrast to Wen's neighbors, whose store windows offered colorful arrays of silk dresses or specialty foods, or a chaotic jumble of cheap imports, Wen's storefront showcased only a trio of intricately carved dark wood panelings. Once inside,
A discreet bronze plate identified the panelings as belonging to such and such a dynasty, but they could now be yours for a mere $150,000. Come to think of it, such price points also explained the fine cut of Mr. Wen's elegant navy blue suit. A man who moved in elite circles and carried himself accordingly. Interesting.
So, businessman, Dee Dee filled in. Educated, obviously. Respected? Trusted?
Phil nodded.
Probably not about theft, she continued,
eyeing the small fortune in jade left around the office.
But maybe a business deal gone bad? Mr. Wen identified the piece as Third Dynasty, when really it was built last week in the finest factory in Hong Kong, then aged by six-year-olds beating it with heavy chains.
Not possible.
A new voice spoke up from behind Phil. He made way as best he could in the cramped doorway, and a beautiful, if solemn, Asian woman appeared.
You are? Dee Dee prompted.
Judy Chan. I have worked with Mr. Wen for 5 years now. He was a good man. He wouldn't cheat, and he didn't make mistakes.
How'd you meet Mr. Wen?
He ran an ad in the paper looking for a store clerk. I answered.
Dee Dee eyed the assistant, taking in the girl's petite frame, elegantly sculpted cheekbones, glossy waterfall of jet black hair. She asked the next logical question.
Please describe your relationship.
The assistant gave her an exasperated look.
I worked with Mr. Wen Wednesdays through Sundays, 9 to 5. Occasionally, I would come in off hours to help him prepare for meetings with some of his more special clients. You know, the kind of people who want a 3,000-year-old armoire as a signature piece in their foyer and are willing to pay for it.
Got a list of said clients?
Yes.
And his calendar. We'll want to see that.
I understand.
Was he meeting with someone last night?
Not that I knew of.
Would he tell you?
Most of the time. His projects were not secret. More and more, he would even ask for my help. He appreciated my computer skills.
When did you last see him?
Yesterday, 5 p.m., when I locked up the store.
Where was he?
Back here, in his office. He generally stayed after the store was closed, catching up on paperwork, researching pieces. He didn't have a family.
This,
Judy gestured around the cramped office.
This was his life.
Was he working on anything special?
Phil asked from beside her.
Not that he had mentioned.
Missing anything special?
He gestured to the crowded space. For the first time, the girl hesitated.
I don't know.
All three Boston detectives studied her.
His office, she said at last. He kept it busy.
Dee Dee raised a brow, considering that the understatement of the month.
Mr. Wen always said he thought better when surrounded by the past. Most of the items in this room were things he'd collected along the way. Gifts from colleagues, clients, friends, and the books. He loved them. Called them his children. I used to beg him to let me at least dust, attempt to tidy up. But he would never let me. He liked things just this way, even the piles of paper covering his desk. The horizontal filing system, he called it. It never failed him.
The girl's voice faded out. She wasn't looking at them, but staring at the desk intently.
It's wrong, she said flatly. I can't tell you how exactly, but it's wrong.
Dee Dee obediently turned her attention to the desk. She noted mounds of paper, a scatter of miscellaneous notebooks, a rounded wooden bowl filled with yet more office detritus, then beside it, a heavily gilded female figurine whose curves were definitely more robust than Dee Dee's own, not to mention multiple haphazard piles of obviously old and dusty books.
I don't see a computer, she ventured at last.
He worked by hand, thought best that way. When he needed to look something up, he used the computer in the front of the store.
Dee Dee went about this another way. Was the stall locked this morning?
Yes.
Security system?
No. We had been talking about one, but Mr. Wen always argued, what kind of thieves stole antique furniture? The truly valuable pieces here, they are large and heavy, as you can see.
But all the jade figurines?
His private collection, not for sale.
Phil picked up the thought. But the door was locked, so whoever entered, Mr. Wen let him or her in.
I would assume.
Would he meet people in his office? Dee Dee asked, gesturing to a space that was clearly standing room only.
No, the assistant filled in. Generally, he met with them in the showroom, sitting at one of the tables, that sort of thing. He believed in the power of history not just to survive, but to retain its usefulness. Don't just buy an antique, he liked to say. Live with it.
Dee Dee's gaze zeroed in once more on the book still resting on Mr. Wen's open hand. Did he have books in the showroom?
No, his
personal collection, I get it. So if he was meeting someone who was interested in a volume, per se.
Dee Dee knelt back down, trying to get a better look at the leather-bound novel. The gilded titling was faded, hard to read. Then she realized it wasn't even in English, but in a language she couldn't recognize. The Buddha, Judy suddenly gasped.
What?
The Buddha. That's what's missing. Here, the left corner of Mr. Wen's desk. He had a solid jade Buddha from the 8th century Tang Dynasty. The Buddha always sat here. Mr. Wen got the piece just after his wife died. It was very special to him.
Size?
Phil already had his notebook out. The Buddha himself, 8 inches tall. Very round, solid, the sitting Buddha, you know, with his round belly and laughing face. The statue was placed on a square wooden base with gold seams and inlaid abalone. A substantial piece.
Value? Dee Dee asked.
I'm not sure. I would need to do more research, but given that ounce for ounce, fine jade is currently more valuable than gold, a piece of that size. Yes, it is valuable.
Dee Dee pursed her lips, liking the idea of the theft gone awry for their murder motive, except, of course, for the number of remaining jade pieces that still littered the victim's bookshelves.
Why the Buddha statue? She murmured out loud, more to herself than anyone.
Judy, the beautiful assistant, shook her head, clearly at a loss for an explanation. One piece? That's all you think is gone?
I will keep looking, but for now, yes, that one piece.
So, Buddha. Something about Buddha. Dee Dee was still thinking as Neil said, Hello, got something.
He had lifted the book from Mr. Wen's outstretched fingers. Now they all watched as something fluttered to the floor. Obviously not old, but a recent addition to the office. Something worth clutching in a dead man's hand?
What is it? Dee Dee asked. Business card.
Neil flipped it over.
From the Phoenix Foundation, for one Malachi Samuels.
Dee Dee parked her rental car on New York's Upper West Side, then turned her attention to the mansion across the street. She wasn't a huge architecture buff, but she had lived in a historic city long enough to recognize the Queen Anne style of the villa, including the glass sunburst below the curved top window. Personally, she liked the gargoyles peeking out from under the eaves. Of course, she wasn't here for the architecture. She was here about a murder. She made her way up the front walk, pausing long enough to inspect the bas-relief coat of arms that decorated the mansion's front door. Took her a second, then she got it. The image was the mystical phoenix that granted the office its name.
Bzzz.
The front door finally opened, and Dee Dee entered the Phoenix Foundation. She presented her credentials to the waiting receptionist.
The front desk, Dee Dee noticed, was very old and most likely very valuable. It also held hints of Chinese design, the kind of desk John Wen might have imported into his shop and sold to a client, such as Malachi Samuels.
Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren, she introduced herself. I'm here to see Dr. Samuels.
Do you have an appointment?
No, but I think he'll see me.
The young woman looked down at Dee Dee's detective shields, then pursed her lips and made a phone call.
If you'll have a seat, the doctor is with a patient, but he'll be free in 15 minutes.
Fair enough.
Dee Dee retreated to the camelback sofa provided for visitors. She'd been warned this interview would not be easy. Dr. Samuels was not without some experience when it came to answering questions involving homicide. For now, she occupied her time on her laptop, reading more of the articles she'd pulled about the esteemed therapist. Malachi Samuels was a Jungian therapist who'd devoted his life to working with children with past life issues. He and his aunt, who was the co-director of the foundation, had documented over 3,000 children's journeys and presented remarkable proof of the lives they'd discovered in their regressions. So fastidious was their research and methodology, they were actually accepted by the scientific community and often spoke at psychiatric conventions. In the last 7 years, however, Malachi had been named a person of interest in several different criminal cases involving stolen artifacts, resulting in the deaths of at least 4 people. The reincarnationist had never been charged with any wrongdoing, but the FBI special crimes detective Dee Dee had contacted, Lucian Glass, was disturbed when he heard Malachi's name was connected to yet another murder. Glass still believed Malachi was complicit in several of the cases and that he should be in prison.
But we've never been able to find any actual evidence of his participation. I hope you do, Detective Warren. I hope you do.
Detective Warren?
A rich, mellifluous voice cut through her thoughts. Dee Dee looked up to find the man in question now standing directly before her.
Dr. Malachi Samuels, how may I be of assistance?
Samuels was wearing a well-cut navy suit, carefully knotted silk tie, and a crisp white shirt with a monogram on the right cuff. Everything about him, from his clothing to his manner of speaking, suggested a gentleman of an earlier time, which already got Dee Dee to thinking. Was the good doctor merely collecting valuable old artifacts, or did he include himself among them?
I'm here about an incident in Boston, she said. Could we talk someplace more private?
Of course. This way.
He led her down a hallway lit by stained glass sconces and lined with turn-of-the-century wallpaper. Silk would be her guess, with a faded floral pattern and hints of what was probably real gold.
Would you like any coffee or tea? Perhaps bottled water?
He asked as he opened the door to what Dee Dee surmised was his personal office. In keeping with the theme of the rest of the place, the space was lined with old books and lushly appointed with a fine Persian rug, an antique desk, and a comfortable leather couch and chairs. It faced an inner courtyard planted with trees and flowers, as befitting someone with a doctor's fine sensibilities. Dee Dee said she'd like some water, then took a seat, still cataloging the plethora of antiques and works of art scattered about. A tingle of excitement shot up her spine when she noticed a Chinese jade horse on Samuels' desk. Malachi handed Dee Dee a crystal glass filled with ice water. He took a seat opposite her on the other side of the glass coffee table.
Now, how can I help you?
We found your business card at the scene of a murder.
That's terrible. Who was killed?
Mr. John Wen.
Malachi's face showed no emotion. In fact, he remained so unruffled that Dee Dee was instantly suspicious.
Did you know him, Doctor?
I'm a therapist, Detective. Even if I did, I couldn't tell you. Everything that goes on in my office is confidential. Surely you understand that.
The man is dead, Dr. Samuels. His confidentiality is on the floor in a pool of blood.
Malachi remained silent.
Surely you understand that by not talking to me, you are as good as admitting he was a patient.
If that's the conclusion you want to draw, so be it. But I'm neither saying he was or wasn't. I'm not at liberty to discuss your case with you.
Your business card was there when he died.
How unfortunate, then, for us both.
Dee Dee frowned, feeling the first tinge of annoyance. Samuels was within his rights, but it was going to make the case more complicated if she had to wait to get a court order. Last time you saw him alive? She fished.
Who said I ever saw him?
Special Agent Lucian Glass had been right. Samuels was good. Dee Dee went about it another way. Hypothetically speaking, if you were a detective investigating the homicide of a man who imported ancient Chinese artifacts, who would you question?
Samuels merely arched a brow.
Then, almost imperceptibly, he tilted his head in the direction of the decorative mirror hanging over his left shoulder. A Freudian slip, Dee Dee thought? Or just the incredible arrogance of a well-respected gentleman who may or may not have gotten away with murder?
I am sorry, Detective, Dr. Samuels informed her, but I cannot assist you in this matter. Now, if you don't mind, I have another patient waiting.
He stood up, and she had no choice but to follow. Show over, meeting adjourned. Dee Dee had wasted an entire day, not to mention a decent portion of her department's budget, on a trip to New York that had yielded her absolutely nothing. Nice horse, she said, pointing at the jade piece as she rose to stand.
Thank you.
Where'd you buy it?
I didn't. Like many objects in this building, I inherited it. I moved it into my office, however, because I find it particularly compelling. Do you know why people collect antiques, Detective Warren?
Aha, finally a little conversation. They like old things?
Perhaps. More accurately, they identify with old things.
Dee Dee couldn't help herself. She gazed around his clearly 19th century office. The good doctor didn't appear offended, more like amused by her unspoken point. Mr. John Wen, she tried one last time, didn't just collect antiques. By all accounts, he believed people should live with them, such as you do.
Exactly.
What does that mean?
That means you're spending too much time in the present, Detective Warren, given that you are investigating a man who was all about the past.
Dr. Samuels granted her one last knowing smile. Then, graciously but firmly, he escorted her out the door. After the Boston detective departed, Malachi returned to his office, where he poured himself an inch of 40-year-old Macallan. Lifting the heavy crystal tumbler, he took a sip, savored it. Then, drink in hand, he sat down heavily in the chair at his desk. Opening his top drawer, he withdrew his Smytheson notebook. This was a private journal that he kept to record his musings on the search, as he had been referring to it for the last 35 years, ever since he'd opened a 19th century book on mesmerism that he'd come across in the library, and a scrap of old yellowed paper had fallen out. The handwriting had been spidery and appeared to have been written with a pen dipped in ink, which, along with what it said, helped Malachi date the note to the mid to late 1800s. Meeting with Mr. T at 2 p.m. regarding place to secure the papers. Wednesday at his